It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, Chris Patterson. Chris is the bassist in the musical comedy trio The Arrogant Worms. The Worms have been playing across Canada and the U.S. for over 20 years, but these days, Chris is earning a living as a high school English teacher. Chris and I discuss how we've both shifted from being on stage to being teachers. We talk about the early days of The Arrogant Worms, and Chris points out how spending 20 years in a musical relationship with two other guys traveling across North America helped him to be a better husband. That's coming up on The Inadequate Life. Hey, thanks for listening. In case you're new here, I publish a new podcast about once every 2 weeks. I try to be consistent with that, generally Mondays early in the week. If you like comedy, be sure to check out my interview with Canadian comedian John Wing. He was just a contestant on America's Got Talent and a very, very funny guy. So that's, I guess, two episodes before this one. Before we get to today's interview, just a reminder, as always, today's podcast is sponsored by Stratford Tea Leaves. Karen Hartwick, who owns and operates the small business, is one of a select few certified tea sommeliers in Canada. So if you like tea as much as I do, and I've got a really smooth single estate Darjeeling going right now, if you like tea as much as I do, go online and visit stratfordtealeaves.com or visit the shop next time you're in Stratford. Okay, been a busy time. School's back. I'm teaching at Western again. Very busy, obviously, with the classes there, teaching in the journalism program and the undergrad program. Saw a lot of tennis. The U.S. Open was so much fun to watch. And I'll get to the podcast in a second, but the I got to see Daniel Nestor in London, Ontario. He came up and did a clinic. And he is probably the world's most celebrated tennis doubles player. And he was at a small event here in London with about, less than 100 people put on by a fellow named Cameron Cross, who has a CIBC group, financial advisor sort of thing. Anyway, it was just an amazing time. And Cole, 7-year-old Cole, got to watch it. And just so cool to see a world-class athlete, like literally at courtside. And just to think about, the man had just got back from the Davis Cup in Serbia, where the Canadians dominated, and the Canadian doubles team, rather, dominated. And then there he was in London. It was amazing to see that. And the theater that happens on the court, especially in a doubles game, because you've got the relationship between the player and his partner, and then there's a whole other energy between, obviously, the player and their adversaries. Anyway, so that's what I've been up to. And tonight, I can't believe it. I'm so excited. Susie and I are going to see Kat Edmondson. She's from Austin, Texas. I got turned on to her by Austin City Limits, and Lyle Lovett did a duet with her. Anyway, her CD is an amazing CD. I've never seen her in concert. I'm very excited. That's tonight. I'll let you know how it was next time we talk. I hope it lives up to my expectations. It's in a small club, the Alma Combo in Toronto. Anyway, so I'll be right now. Actually, I invited Chris to come, but he's going out as well tonight. A rare thing. He's got twins. Tough to get out, eh? Anyway, we did the interview in his home. I sat downstairs in his office, his basement office, and I was surrounded by all these different artifacts of Chris's life in Canadian show business, you know, some of the CDs, pictures of the people he's worked with. And then I looked over my shoulder, and I saw Chris's Peter Zosky Award for Literacy. Peter Zosky is one of Canada's most well-regarded journalists and interviewers. For years, he hosted the most popular show on CBC Radio. And one of his favorite things, one of his favorite charities, obviously, was literacy, and he had a golf tournament. And Chris and the Worms played at that golf tournament and did as much as they can to help promote literacy in Canada. And the award, it struck me as I was sitting there how much of a testament it was to the Arrogant Worms' continued efforts to give back to the community. And you don't often hear comedians talking about that kind of work, and I know the Arrogant Worms do that sort of work. And it's just not something, you know, athletes often talk about their foundations and their charities, and less so with comedians. It's not something they do. So it was nice to see that that they were recognized for doing so much for literacy. And given that Chris these days is teaching English at a high school, it's no surprise that literacy has been a cause that he's personally been dedicated to for years. The interview We covered a lot of ground, and it was weird because we've known each other, so I hope you enjoy it. I had a good time talking to him, hadn't seen him for a while. We talk about everything from, you know, being teachers, both of us being teachers, and how some of the things we did on stage we can use in the class. And we talk about how a group whose comedy depends so much on Canadian comedic references broke into the U.S. market. And I actually traveled with them once to a show in Pittsburgh, and they did it. I mean, no, they were doing all kinds of material, and some of it even Canadian, with Canadian references, Rocks and Trees, their big song about the Canadian geographical landscape. And the audience was just as much into it in Pittsburgh as they are at a show anywhere in Canada. It was pretty amazing. Anyway, it was lots of fun catching up with Chris. Here it is. Hope you enjoy it. So this is pretty bizarre, because how long have we known each other? For a long time.
For, well, I probably would have met you in like maybe 90, 96 or 97. The first time I met you was probably when we did the John Oakley show on TV on the Life Network.
That's right.
I think. But you would have known Mike and Trevor from the radio show.
Yeah,
before.
The radio show with Jack Farr. Because I had met them. I had met them in the Arrogant Worms in Winnipeg at a Fringe Festival. We were doing, me and Gary were doing the outdoor stage. And then these three guys from Kingston, I guess, came on. And we're like, oh, those guys are pretty good. This is excellent. So, yeah. And then when I was at the radio show and I had a chance to, you know, showcase Canadian music and comedy, I'm like, okay, this is the bomb.
Yeah. And then you got in touch with us when you started doing the Oakley TV show.
Right.
Live on Life.
Now, I love the story
you tell.
Which I
still have a tape of, I think.
Are you serious?
I think I do, yeah.
I haven't, you know, none of that stuff exists. And as well as you guys, we had on, you know, Louis C.K. came on that show.
Really?
Wow. Ray Romano came on that show. Robert Smigel, who's a great, you know, now he's a writer, but back then he was doing the, on Saturday Night Live, you know, TV, what was it called?
TV Funhouse.
TV Funhouse, yeah.
And he was a writer for Conan too, wasn't he?
Yeah. So we had Robert Schimmel, one of my favorite comedians, came on that show twice.
Wow.
So, yeah, you were in pretty good company.
Well, and John's pretty hooked into comedy too,
right? Of course,
right?
Yeah. He's got the comedy club in Montreal. Right.
He still has it?
Yeah, I believe he does. So you didn't study music. Are you trained? I guess that's where I'm going with this. Did you do musical theater at Queens or anything?
No. Well, I took, I was a drama major.
Okay.
And that was fine. Like Queens is, it's a decent drama school. They have a good drama program. Yeah. It's not a theater school by any means, but they have a pretty good drama program.
So what kind of stuff were you doing there?
Well, it was mostly like a lot of like sort of serious plays and scene work and, you know, some Judith Thompson plays we would do, and we'd study everything like from, like, you know, Sharon Pollock plays like Blood Relations and stuff like that to, you know, the odd bit of Shakespeare, some Chekhov, like a lot of classics. And it was a pretty well-rounded, like there wasn't one sort of focus area.
So let's talk about, where do you get the Canadiana thing? I mean, one of the wonderful things about the Arrogant Worms is you're so Canadian. Where does that whole thing, was there ever a choice to go, we're going to reflect on the Canadian experience? Or,
I mean, probably at first we knew it was the best way to get played on CBC radio. Honestly, like, we knew that if we had some CanCon,
that's so funny.
That not just being Canadian was enough. We actually had to sing about it. And Canada's full of funny things.
And you guys do a fair amount of work in the States too, though.
Yeah, yeah, we certainly have. I mean, for a while, like a third of our work was in the U.S.
And when you go there, how does the Canadian stuff play? Do you have to skew it so that it's making fun of Canada?
Because, well, and we're like self-deprecating at the best of times anyhow. So, but Americans, they don't always get that kind of humor right away. Like we have to ease into it sometimes at shows where we're not known.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're playing like a show in a place that we've never played in the United States, it takes a little while for them to get what we're doing. Like that everyone, like it's not that they're wary, but if we're sort of making fun of Canada, they're thinking, why would you make fun of your country?
Right.
You know, like that's just something they don't do there necessarily.
That's a really interesting point.
Yeah. And so once they realize that, no, we're doing it out of like pride in our own country, then it's okay.
That's a big twist.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a twist that they're not really used to seeing like in comedy. I mean, you have something like, you know, there's Colbert and like he makes fun of the big America.
Right.
But
that's
in a character too.
Sure.
Like
it's some
comics are do a lot of that stuff, but it would be rare for like a for them to see like a trio of foreigners make fun of the country that they're coming from in the country that they're not from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's
That's amazing you guys managed to make that work.
Yeah. And
because you're doing like Rocks and Trees and they don't know what you're talking about.
Or, well, yeah. And for the longest time, we never did the Canadian material in the U.S. at all.
Hmm.
But then...
That's a whole different show.
Yeah, it's a very different show. But then once we started getting known, people would buy the albums, then they'd want to hear it. So they would request it. And a song like Last Saskatchewan Pirate is
just,
so
exactly
it's
what
so
I was just thinking
it's
of.
So
hey,
specific.
Yeah.
It's so specific and so regional to Canada. I mean, everyone in Canada knows where Saskatchewan is, but outside of Canada, they would never know.
And the joke, you know, the Saskatchewan Pirate.
Yeah, and so we would often have to set up that that thing, like, well, Saskatchewan's like North Dakota, only colder and flatter, and
so you're introducing the song.
Yeah, so you're creating this huge sort of context, and the intro is longer than the song.
Not slow, and that's the thing. Then it becomes a pacing issue for the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And is it in a history book or is that my imagination? Is that the song?
It's in an English textbook, a grade 9 English textbook. Yeah. And there's something in the science book and there's something in a history book as well.
Hmm. So at some point something it's like out there in the ether. So going back to the whole thing with Joseph and the audition. At what point your father was a teacher and that's a choice we make. It's like, okay, this is a regular gig. That's what I do now. What did your dad say when you went, or both your parents, when you went into showbiz and touring? You know, it's...
They were very supportive of it. And because even like I wasn't sure when I first started, I thought this might work for a year, even though The Worm's been going for like 2.5 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't really I knew that they had toured and stuff. I didn't really realize how big it was or how big it could be. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing. And, you know, for a while, like in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, like we were working 150 shows a year.
That's busy. Yeah.
Which
touring.
Is,
which
was a lot,
yeah.
You know, and we were away for like long stretches of time.
And so, but go back a bit. So between the time when you first got into the band and that the pinnacle of success there, was there ever a time you thought you questioned it? You thought maybe I need to get a job or a second skill or something like that?
Yeah, like as about 5 years in, I realized it wasn't, maybe this is going to be more than just a thing, like just a hobby.
Ah,
like,
okay, yeah.
I don't know if a little switch went off in my head that this is now a career. I mean, it was what I did.
And
I
did you ever, in those early days, have another job?
No.
So you've never had a job?
No, I'd never had a job for, you know, 17 years of doing the band until now that I have a job. Yeah. So it's, that was my whole thing. And because I couldn't have sustained another job, like even just time-wise or being able to commit to anything else. Like that was the thing. Like, yeah, even when I went back to school, I was thinking it's a good thing the band is slowing down because I want to give obviously all my energy to whatever I'm doing, and you know, in last year that was school. Yeah. So but before I couldn't have I couldn't even have up until a few years ago gotten an agent for any acting gigs because I just couldn't I knew I'm gonna be away for 2 weeks this month and so it was difficult to be able to commit to anything, and I don't like to say I can do something and then not be able to
do it. Of course,
yeah.
You have to book out for the band.
Yeah. So, and I felt weird about doing that with agents because, I mean, they're, you know, they only get paid when, if you know, if their actors
course.
Get paid. And you want to make yourself as available as possible.
You were too nice.
Too nice.
You're a nice guy.
Yeah. My curse.
My curse.
It's because I'm so religious.
So yeah. So the band was. That's the job thing is a good. It's an interesting thing because a lot of people say, "Oh, I'm going to get into the arts and I have to be a waiter to support myself."
Or, right.
So you were really fortunate, and you guys work, as you said, you worked really hard.
Yeah, we worked really hard at not having other jobs.
Motivator.
Yeah, for sure. And because we knew that if we had other jobs, then we wouldn't be as free to go and take some chances. And we're all at ages and sort of.
Ever a time when you were in the early days and you were like, I don't know if I can hang out with these guys 100 times a year?
For sure. And then you sort of realize that
you're stuck. Basically, you're going to be stuck.
Yeah. That, you know, if the band has a fight in Northern BC, like you have to wait until you get somewhere else before, you know what I mean? Like you're there. It's not like you're just going to stay in Prince Rupert and let
the
other guys go.
If the band has a fight, what does that mean?
Well, it's just kind of like, you hear of bands like fighting all the time. We never really fought, and we don't. I mean, but it's just like
you all get your own separate room. Was there a time when you'd share rooms on the road?
Yeah, there was in the first couple of years for sure. We were sharing rooms, and that was sometimes we'd all be in one room. Sometimes we'd all like just be sleeping on the same guy on the same billet's floor or whatever. And then we'd be able to ask for two rooms, and then our agent just said, you know what, like, I'm just going to ask for three rooms. It's not ridiculous to ask for three rooms.
$150 or something more.
Yeah. And it's going to keep your band together. And so anytime any young band says, like, what, you guys have been at this for so long, what is the secret? Like, is it songwriting? Is it creative? Like, it, and I said, no, it's separate hotel rooms and being able to separate yourselves on the road. Because even though, like, the show is 2 hours, but you're driving in Canada, sometimes 8 hours between shows, and you're spending a lot of time, you know, in airports and bus stations and all that
unpleasant
stuff, right? It's unpleasant time.
Yeah.
The show time is always, like, of course, matter what happened during the day, it doesn't matter during the show because it's just fun and the audience is there. So they've paid to come see you, so you owe them.
So it's not like at the hotel you're having breakfast together.
No. No, no,
no, yeah, no, I get you.
And like, even like, honestly, even if I go down to like the breakfast room, because we stay at the classy places and they have continental breakfast with the waffle machine that you turn over, I would even like, I'd sort of like do a little walk first around the lobby just to see if any of the other guys were in there. Cause then, like, you know, if there's only one other guy in there and there's like 10 tables,
it's weird.
It's like, am I really going to go sit over here now and just read the paper? So you kind of do a little lap first and like just, or it's like, oh, just seeing what they have down here. And I'm just going to go back to my room cause I forgot something or something like that.
Like, oh no. Like, really?
No, sure. Yeah. But like, cause you just like, or some, like sometimes you just sort of,
cause
you know that you're going to be in the van for 8 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
So whatever you're going to talk about is probably going to get covered in the van,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, people,
how does this affect your marital habits? Because, you know, if you develop these habits for like 10 years on the road,
yeah,
you marry someone, you got to have breakfast with them at the hotel.
I figured I was probably more sort of, I was better trained for marriage because I was already in this long-term relationship with these other people.
I'm not sure about not having breakfast with the guy and going back to the hotel room is good training.
Yeah, but it's,
or maybe it
but
is,
my sort of financial success, it wasn't like hinged on my other relationships. You know, like this is like with these guys, like if, you know, this is my sort of job. Like, well, we always got along well,
sure,
and still do, but we always sort of, it was more like we're coworkers who get along rather than best friends who are in a band together.
Right.
And
maybe those are the ones who break up. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, because then you don't know how to, like if someone is bugging you, you don't know how to tell them if you're best friends, you know?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
like,
no, that's true. Yeah.
There's a bit of that. So
we have to talk about that as friends, all the problems that I've caused your life.
Yeah, exactly. Like today. But
so here's the deal. I showed up. This is for the listeners. I showed up thinking today was the day for the podcast interview. I drove to Chris's house and, you know, he said he'd be picking up the kids. So I'm waiting on the staircase and he said his wife was going to be away. And all of a sudden his wife's walking. It's a beautiful neighborhood, by the way. I love it here. Great hood. And his wife's walking on the street. I'm like, oh, I thought he said she wasn't coming over. That's odd. And then she gives me that. What are you doing here? Look. And I'm like, I think we're doing an interview today. And she goes, oh, and I'm like, oh, it's not today. So then I just insert myself into your lives. You know, two kids, your wife's got stuff to do, you got stuff to do, the kids need to be, and here I am.
That's hilarious because my neighbor, who always sits on the porch and smokes,
he's
like neighborhood watch.
Yeah.
And so he was like, hey, there was a guy here looking for you. And I was like, oh, yeah. Is he still here? Like, I don't know what happened to him. I just went inside to warm up my tea, and now he's gone. I'm like, oh, well, okay, that's fine. I'm sure he'll come back. Did he say what his name was? Yeah. What is it? I can't remember.
Okay. That's what the kind of neighborhood watch guy you want.
Well, exactly. And I said, did he ask for me by name? Because I'm starting to get a little suspicious that there was just some guy sitting
collector
on our porch. Because I was like, no, Keith's obviously coming tomorrow. There's no way he would make that mistake.
No. Because I've made it before. Have we made that mistake before? No.
I'm sure we've probably done something like that. But then I came in the back door and you were already in my house.
Yeah, that's true.
I was, okay,
well, your
fine.
Wife let me in. It was all okay.
True. Yeah, it was fine.
But no, the other thing I love is that I book you on these shows. So I got you on the first time I put you on the Bullard show, which was back in the early days of the Comedy Network.
Yeah. It's the second ever episode of the Bullard show.
Is that right?
Yeah.
wow, I really trusted you guys.
Yeah.
That's because my ass is on the line because they don't know me.
Just started the job.
I applied for that job. Here's a great story for people who want to get into show business. I sent them a resume because I heard there was this new show coming up, and this is what I do. And they never get back to me. And so I call them. They're like, oh, thanks. I think all the jobs are filled. And I'm like, oh, that kind of sucks. But then I was persistent, and I called them back a few weeks later, and then I kind of weaseled my way in, and they're like, okay, he can do the job. But yeah, no, I didn't realize it was the second show.
Yeah.
But the Oakley show, the one on with John Oakley on the Life Network, you guys used to bug me about this. I wasn't there. I booked you guys on the show.
That's right, then, and you weren't there.
And I wasn't there. I don't know what happened that. But then I think the same thing happened the Bullard show.
Yeah, you weren't there that night.
How
either,
does that happen?
I don't know.
So you guys would always...
Because you didn't even do the pre-interview. It was someone else.
Really?
Yeah.
What was going on in my life?
I don't know what that was. Like there was some other event in town or something like that.
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Bizarre.
But you think you'd be there on the second night. But yeah, you weren't.
No.
And that was at Gretzky's.
Yeah, that's right. Back in the thing. And I think that's the only... And then the third time when you did Bullard and you met Kurt Browning, that was a fun... And then when I showed... I was there for that one, wasn't I?
Oh, Kurt Browning was the first time we did it.
Was it?
Yeah, he was on the show with us that night. And... So maybe you were there the first night. It was one of the other ones that you weren't there for. But yeah, but then Kurt, that became a friendship out of that show, out of that Bullard show when Kurt Brown, because then we gave him a copy of our Christmas CD, and then he worked in one of our Christmas songs into one of his like holiday Stars on Ice shows.
Huge.
So then, so we were like got all this like international play because it was on TBS or something
That's
like that.
That's amazing, yeah.
And then, we had Kurt do a thing in our, a piece in our DVD where we skated with him in Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto.
How fun is that?
He was wearing a Mountie costume.
So the folks at home, where can they get all these things?
Well, they can get all these things at arrogantworms.com.
Did we have anything other than that failed, game show idea?
There's the game show. Which was, I think, good. It was called Smarty Pants.
Oh, yeah.
Not that we want to give away the
ideas.
I
wouldn't have remembered that. That's amazing.
I think I still have the script somewhere. I'm sure I do.
Well, I remember I let you down. I felt like I let you down in the script writing department. No? You're giving me that no
look. I don't think so. No.
Really? I thought you were all pissed off at me.
No, not at all. Like, we did the show. Did we do it in London first?
Yeah, we got money from the Comedy Network to develop a pilot. And the idea that what I brought to the table with you was, what if Michael Moore had a game show?
Yes, that's right.
That was always my hook.
That's how smart we were going to make it.
I know. I'd like to have and I think there's still room for that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, there's plenty of room for a smart game show on the Comedy Network.
Well, the game show they ended up going with had like gambling and hot babes. So
yeah.
I don't know
why we didn't think of that.
No, gambling and hot babes.
What? So yeah,
no, but I thought
Michael Moore. No, not that guy. We want hot babes.
Here's what I remember about the trying to make this thing work, because it's a creative thing. You had your life, I had my life, and I remember having. I think we were both supposed to write so many of the quiz questions.
Yeah,
and I was living in London, and I remember feeling I had not delivered really good questions. I felt, you don't remember that, eh?
No.
Oh, that's good. Okay, that's my own personal...
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, all right.
So you thought I was mad at you?
For years, I thought you were mad at me that I let you down. Because it could have been a big deal, and it ended up... So you're right. You came to London. We did a dry run through in London, and just like a community kind of hall sort of thing.
Yeah, like outside of town, like kind of rural, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, you want the...
Yeah. And we had that kid.
I don't remember the kid.
The kid was like the scorekeeper kid.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he was great.
So we did a dry run through there and then watched it and recorded it. And then we did another one in Toronto at a small theater.
Yeah.
And then the folks on the network came and decided.
No, they didn't come.
Oh, they don't.
Remember the main network woman.
But there was a secondary one, wasn't there?
Well, the main person, I can't remember her name now. But anyway, she didn't come. She was sick or something like that.
Okay.
So she didn't come. So we filmed it.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Like just kind of crudely thinking. We kind of had to throw it like, hey, does anyone have a camera? Because we need to film this because they're not coming or something like that. I was kind of, that's the thing that was, because it kind of petered out that way.
It petered out, quickly.
Yeah, because it would sort of said to us that they weren't really interested in the first place.
Well, the person not showing up.
Yeah, but they had already, like, they had already written the check, so whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was just a lost leader.
That was too bad.
Yeah, but it was... because then we did it in Toronto and actually had someone kind of produce it a little bit get people there.
There's an audience. Yeah. And I think everyone had fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we got great feedback from it and all that sort of stuff. But it was just, you know, it was a fun thing to work. It was, you know, a couple months of work. And, we each put a, I don't know,
a little bit of money
$1,000 in our pockets maybe. But
for the tax man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember what we did with you guys. I remember when I went to Pittsburgh with you guys. I was working on America Online. And we had you guys doing a live chat on AOL.
Yeah, we did a live chat on AOL.
Back in, like, this is 2000. This is so ahead of the game.
Yeah. And Kurt did a live chat on AOL, too.
Well, all my friends were coming on to do live chats on AOL. Anyone. It's like, come on.
All the luminaries of Canadian show business.
Anybody I could get. No, that's not true, actually. I mean, no, it was a good time. But we were ahead of the curve in 2000. People are on dial-up modems.
Yeah, so that's true.
A live chat. Yeah. So let's talk about the shift. So I made the shift. Well, you know, I made the shift from being involved in production to being in teaching, clearly. And I, you know, in previous times of my life, I had always taught, and I'd never even envisioned it. I didn't have that model that you had. You had a dad who was a teacher, so you could actually see that path. I never saw that path at all until I married a teacher.
Yeah, and well, I mean, that path was actually my original path. I remember when I was in high school, I wanted to apply to concurrent education and to do Con Ed at Queens, where I ended up going. I didn't get into Con Ed, and so I just went in for the sort of the general BA. But then I thought, I can still apply to Teachers College after I'm finished with my BA. So that was sort of still in my head a little bit.
So that was the backup plan.
That was the front plan. Like, that was the front burner.
Okay.
And then the band kind of interrupted that path.
That's
for 17 years.
Wow.
And then I went back to Teachers College and turned 40 in Teachers College, which was kind of weird. Not because it was 40, but just like...
Everyone else was 23.
Everyone else was 23. And they're like, hey, Chris, like, we're going out tonight. I'm like, why? It's Tuesday. Like, I'm having shake and bake. Like, I'm going home after this.
Yeah.
Like, oh, really? We're going to go out and party. Like, okay.
Great. Yeah,
have a good time. Yeah. Like, because, you know, they didn't have kids, like, jumping on their face at 5:30
in the morning.
Or a wife that had to go to work.
Of course,
so, yeah. But yeah, the Teachers College thing was a lot of sort of decision making, you know, both by my wife and I, who we were, because the band was starting to slow. I had also been doing the kids music thing and put out a kids album.
That's right. That was cool. I mean, I love that CD. What's it called? Just Chris Patterson.
Small potatoes.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a fun CD. There's another little plug for that if anyone wants to get it.
ChrisPatterson.ca is where you'd find that.
I've never plugged anything on the show, by the way.
Oh, really?
It's the first podcast I've ever had anybody do too.
Just, well, let's name some sponsors. did the kids thing.
Yeah.
And then even like the kids thing and the Worms, like collectively, it still wasn't like, you know, really,
so you went
filling
from 100
my days.
Going from 100 some odd dates a year to what,
yeah. And like, one of the other guys in the band was going back to school as well.
Okay.
So we knew we were kind of slowing things down gradually.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had been around for 20 years.
That's a long time.
And, you know, we're not a novelty anymore. We're just like another band who's been around for a while. So your booking window sort of gets bigger, right?
Yeah.
So it used to be that as a novelty, we could, you know, work a town like every 12 to 18 months. And now it's like, we really need 2 years,
between. I'd say, yeah.
So two and a half, and then you sort of, you build up your audience, or you maintain your audience,
right.
But you know that you're not going to get, like if you play to 500 people in Winnipeg, you're not going to get 30 new people every single time you play.
Here's what drives me crazy about you guys. So you're not, listen to me, not telling you what to do, but you guys, I don't think you're leveraging social media as much as you could.
We're not, for sure. We now have 10,000 fans or whatever it's
called.
And
that's without even trying.
Facebook. Yeah, that's without touring very much.
You guys have such a loyal core audience. And that's like those 10,000, it's not like you work, like I teach social media at the university and I've you know, worked with some companies to try and help them build their social media profile. You guys have 10, and you didn't like spend money or time on that, really.
No. And we realized that, you know, it's funny, like our fans are very internet savvy, and a lot of them were sort of...
Oh, here, let me plug myself just to interrupt you.
Yeah.
If they are listening, they should go to iTunes and give this podcast 5 stars.
Absolutely.
That'll help everybody.
Absolutely.
Help you, help me. Sorry, okay, keep going.
So you're loyal.
We
realize
leverage
that
your fans. That's the social media trick.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll take your audience.
So that's how you do it. You actually talk to them directly.
Yeah.
But we were just kind of like, not necessarily Luddites with the whole thing, but...
No, you weren't.
It's
you guys
that
had a
whole,
good website.
And you know what? There's a whole, like, there's a kind of a Canadian thing too, where like the self-promotion stuff is the part that we've...
I don't buy that.
No? Well, but it's the part that we've never really relished doing. I mean, because we had to do a lot of our own press for a long time, right? Yeah. So every once in a while for a project, we would have a publicist who would talk about us, and that was great. But when you're sort of drumming it up yourself, it's a little
bit
different.
Especially if you're doing 108 gigs a year.
Like, yeah, yeah. So that was more of like an extra sort of full-time job to do that. So the self-promotion stuff we've never been especially good at or especially comfortable with.
Right.
But our fans were underserved by us.
Yeah.
In that regard. And so Trevor in the band, I'll give him credit for doing more of that stuff and for sort of pursuing it and, you know, setting up the Twitter and the Facebook and all that stuff. And the Twitter, the Facebook, it's like, I'm such an idiot. Oh, you know, on the computer.
Yeah.
But that was him kind of realizing, oh man, like we're not really doing this properly. So we've started to scratch the surface a little bit and, you know, we're trying to tweet more. But we realized the power of it when in February we went on a tour in a weekend in Alberta, and the airline lost my bass guitar for a while. And it was we were doing two shows. We flew out to Calgary on a national airline, and my bass didn't come on that flight. And so after checking in with, like, the whole story is that checked in at the airport, tried to get it back, called the call center many, many, many times, and they said, oh yeah, it'll be there. We'll bring it by courier to your gig, which was actually not in Calgary, but outside of Calgary.
Oh, road, yeah.
So, and then the next gig was even further away from Calgary. So I had sort of assumed that the bass was then sort of following me around. So we didn't have it the first night, had to borrow a bass. And then the second night, they said, oh yeah, it'll be there for sure. And then on the way to the gig, they said, oh yeah, we should have it there tomorrow morning. I said, well, we're not going to be here tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
They said, okay, cause it's just been at the airport the whole time. It hasn't actually gone anywhere. I'm like, you know what? Send it home. So the bass got home before I did. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I wrote a song about it and put it on YouTube and sort of referenced it on our Twitter and our Facebook, and got so much traction and so much feedback. Like it was our most, you know, viewed post on Facebook, our most commented on post. And mostly it was because other people had similar experiences I mean, if you think of, you know, Dave Carroll, who did United Breaks Guitars.
Of course.
And that, like, that's his industry now.
Yeah.
His speaking about is about customers' rights. And he does TED Talks and all over America. You know, he wrote a song about an airline breaking his guitar.
Yeah.
And that became, you know, David versus Goliath sort of thing, right? And it became just enormous. And he's been able to sustain it. So he's doing that very, very well. We actually got a retweet, because then I started a bit of a war with the airline on Twitter, because they have a social media person who trolls
offline
for their name.
That's the first thing you do is you take it offline.
Yeah.
Thank you for your complaint. Give me a call. Give me an email.
Yeah, exactly. But I was smart enough not to let them do that. So I sort of kept it going and sort of kept up the public shaming a little bit on social media, and, you know, ended up getting a retweet from him. So then, you know, 15,000 other people saw it too.
Right. How did the story end? Did they give you any kind of compensation?
They haven't yet. I'm still working on it.
Huh.
Because then I got busy doing other things.
Of course.
They offered me like 20% off my next flight. And I said, well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I need at least two flights.
What can you do for me?
What can you do for me?
You remember that?
That's what I learned from you. For, like, you know, see, Mr. Keith Tomasek is never afraid just to ask for something, whether it be like extra salad dressing or whatever it is. Like, it's
well,
like,
that was
what
airline.
Can you do for me?
That was an airline. We were stuck. What happened? We were stuck in some. It was one of those golf things in the U.S. And I was trying to get home early or something, and the airline was completely inflexible. Even though, like, you know, whatever. I remember that made you laugh because I love it. One of my
what can you do for me? Okay, I realize you've outlined your position. But my question remains, what can you do for me?
I'm the customer. I'm always the customer. Right.
You're the airline, and you're going to be an airline tomorrow. I might not be your customer tomorrow.
Yeah.
You need to keep me.
They don't really care. That's the sad truth. Huh?
Yeah.
But for me, it was always fun hanging around you, was to try and make you laugh, because you're a hard guy to make laugh, right?
Really?
So, oh, I think so, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I remember moments when I would make you laugh, and that was one of my favorite moments, making you laugh. Not that I was trying to make you laugh on purpose, you're just laughing.
Because you were actually under some strife with the airline at the time, but yeah.
It was very unpleasant.
Yeah, but that I learned that from you, like that. Just if you want something, just ask.
You gotta
for
ask.
It. I'm not good at that, but
right.
I'm getting better at it. And well, you know, my wife has been very good about saying, just ask for it, or
sure.
Like go get it. If you think something is yours, go get it.
Well,
sort of
the classic thing is the third hotel room. Like there's three guys. Why are you only asking for two?
Yeah,
that's sort of, you know. But even with this podcast, which I started because I really wanted to reconnect with people that I met previously, mm-hmm. meet some new cool people, and get their stories. You know, midlife crisis that I'm having and all that. And I just started. I said, oh, I'm just going to ask people. And the response has been amazing. I just actually asked a guy on Twitter, a really famous magician on Twitter, who I just think is, he's one of the top magicians in the world. And I tweeted that I was excited to see his show. And he tweeted back and said, oh, that's cool. So then I said, okay, now, what the heck? So I just asked him on Twitter, hey, do you want to come on the podcast? And I think it's going to happen.
Great.
It was amazing. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, actually. But here's talking about making people laugh. So I like, for me, making you laugh was always cool. But now I'm watching your kids making you laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always knew that I would like my children. I wouldn't have had them if I didn't think I was going to like them.
Well, they could, sometimes I tell people, it's like asking to open your, it's like having a B&B and you never know who's going to show up, but you're stuck with them forever.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Well, yeah. and we, I think we have a pretty decent kids and very, very entertaining children, but I don't know if my threshold for humor has gone up or gone down, but they just make us laugh constantly.
Yeah.
And it's weirdest things. Like sometimes if they're really mad, I laugh.
Right.
because that's funny.
And you don't want to humiliate them though at the same time.
Well, like my son is someone who usually has a smile on his face.
Yeah.
And so when he gets mad, he can't even sustain a grumpy face for more than like 5 seconds. Then he starts smiling. My daughter can sustain her grumpiness a little bit longer, but that's funny too.
Right.
Yeah. It's like you're just so full of like life and energy, and it's ridiculous that you're so upset about like your boot isn't right.
Right.
Or something. Yeah. Or it's, they're on the wrong feet.
Yeah.
It's no big deal. Yeah. We're almost home and you're in a wagon. You're not even standing up.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Stop yelling at me.
And then do you find you try to make them laugh?
Yeah, for sure. I've always tried to use that no matter what, whether it's been an awkward adult situation.
Right.
Anything in a classroom, like if I didn't like know the answer, like, oh, what about, look over here, it's the laugh is kind of distracting.
My fear with doing that with, so my guys are a little older than your guys now, but I think, am I turning this guy into the class clown? That's my fear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'll know a parent teacher night, but.
So far they say no.
Yeah.
I've already asked him. I said, is he like a disruptive and making the kids laugh? Because he makes us laugh.
Yeah.
And he'll consciously try to make us laugh.
Yeah.
And so far the answer is no. But that does concern me a little.
Yeah. I mean, because mine are younger, and like we sometimes hear from their daycare teacher that they're like, maybe they're just in an extra silly phase right now.
No, they're just being polite.
Well, yeah, exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's like, so like how silly, like disruptively
the extra
silly?
Silly phase right
like,
now.
Like, is it silly like you're silly enough to go sit in that chair for a little while by yourself and face the corner?
Yeah.
It's kind of nuts how entertaining they are and how...
And well, that's the other thing, too, is we have to remember, the guy who wrote My Dinner with Andre, I forget his name, he's in a lot of Woody Allen movies, playwright, Wallace Shawn.
Mm.
He's got a great line in My Dinner with Andre, that film, and it's about, I came to a point in my life when I realized everyone on Earth was not there for my entertainment.
But, I mean, it's funny, like, the outside of, like, after shows, and I think I might have touched on this before, like, people who meet us, the worms after shows, they're expecting... the stage Chris, Mike, and Trevor, which are it's essentially us, like inflated versions of ourselves, right?
Sure.
We're amplified. But they're expecting like shtick all the time.
Right.
And so you know, at like a festival is a great sort of example where you have lots of downtime. Yeah, you're just hanging around. Yeah. And they're like, I thought you'd be just joking all the time. And I'd always think, I can't imagine anything more exhausting than being on all the time. I know people who are on all the time, and it must, and sometimes it works. Like I can't imagine sustaining that all the time and just being like, sometimes you just, your brain needs to take a little bit of a rest. Right. And I also sort of think like, well, we've done the show now, and now you're meeting, you know, just me, the guy.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's enough. If it's not.
Have you ever had stalker? Sounds like you've had a stalker.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it scary?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, for sure.
In Toronto or out on the road?
It was on the roads. On the road, I think.
Did you have to get the law involved?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's one of those. It's probably an offline conversation, I think.
Hello. All right. Yeah. Well, probably for legal reasons, if you had the law involved. But that's a hard thing to deal with.
Yeah. Right? Well, but it's not even that. That sort of one. That's just like a weird sort of like
anomaly.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But I think for the most part, like if you think of like even now, like in teaching, like my classroom style is fairly. You know, there's a certain amount of stand-up going on, right? Mm-hmm. Anything you can do to engage kids. And I'm teaching like teenagers now, right? So anything I could do to get them on side and to try and like get them to learn something. Yeah. So like even at the end of a class where I think, okay, well, I think they were entertained, but hopefully they learned something as well. And then you don't always know that, you know, like, okay, I got some laughs today, but is like, should a teacher
have you come home and said that? Because I've come home and said that to my wife. I had a great, you know, there was this great moment in class where something happened.
Yeah.
And it was, and I'm like, and she's a teacher much more than I am. And she's like, yeah, exactly the question. But are they learning?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I hope I'm conveying something.
Oh, yeah, the learning part.
Well, and for me, the one thing I learned from Susie is that you created, if they're laughing, you've created as long as they're not laughing out of nervous laughter where you're attacking them, right?
Right, right.
Which I don't think we do.
It's pretty rare.
Yeah, exactly. I've made a comment about someone's clothing and realized, oh, I probably shouldn't have said that.
Right.
Because it might have not, they might have perceived it the wrong way.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of got that out of my system. Yeah. But my wife's point about the teaching is you've created a space. If there's laughter, that's a good thing because the kids are relaxed, you know.
Exactly.
So you brought it down to that level. And as long as you make it a participatory thing where everyone can participate without losing control, then you've created a space for learning. And you might not even be, you know, the conduit. You just, there might be some kind of relationships amongst themselves that you create because we learn from each other. You know?
Yeah.
We don't learn by the guy standing in front of the board and putting things on
You know,
we learn from the conversations we have with each other.
I think I have a conversational sort of style, and I like discussion, and I like getting people involved. Even if they're not ready to be involved,
I do that
I still
too,
call on
but
people.
I've had people say, why are you picking on me?
Yeah,
I've had class. This is interesting. And I don't mean the picking on. I'll literally say, you know, Fred, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
And then you don't realize. So now I actually, at the beginning of the year, I'll say to the students, I'm going to call on you. I like to have a discussion in the class. We're all going to try to participate. If there's a reason you don't like to participate, let me know so I won't call on you because there are some people who just don't feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You kind of figure these things out as you kind of go along, you know.
So I mean, I use humor as much as I can in the classroom, but then like some days you're just not in a good humor, right? Like, like it's, you got splashed on the way in,
throwing up at night, it's in 4 a.m.
Well, and you just come in and you just sort of say, yeah, well, it's a work period, get your books out, you know, and don't mess with me today.
I kind of can't do that.
but they notice right away.
Oh,
like
for sure,
the students notice, like
wrong.
if there's something like not right, it's like, oh, Mr. Patterson's like, you know, it's rare, and I can usually snap out of it because someone in the class will normally say something funny.
I know you bring it up to
and
the
they
level.
Can they do to me what I had been doing to them sort of
oh,
thing
that's
or
very cool.
for me and for them
yeah
So it's easy to get lifted out of that once you've already created that atmosphere.
Exactly. That's what it gets back to.
So it's sort of like there's a bit of a net underneath you, I think, a little bit if you have that engagement.
But it's fun to watch the students figure out that you're open to that. Because a lot of other, I think, professors don't like that kind of conversation within a class or don't know how to manage it and sort of
direct it. Yeah, exactly. And that, I think, was probably the biggest advantage I had going into teaching and in teacher's college because I had all this performance skill and experience. So I knew how to
manage a room.
I knew how to work a room. And that's a big part of teaching is working the room. Cause if you don't have the room worked, then they're not going to work in the room. So I see a lot of people going into teaching with the greatest of intentions, like, oh, I really want to do this for the kids, but they don't know how to work a room yet. So there's a lot of that stuff. Like, I mean, you know, you've worked lots of rooms and you're still working rooms every day. Right. Yeah. And so that's kind of what I'm doing now. So when people say, oh gosh, why are you teaching now? Like, what about entertainment? I said, well, I'm still kind of doing it, you know, and the band is still going at, you know, to a lesser extent for now anyway, until we have a new album and then we'll tour a little bit more. But I'm still on stage every single day.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And now, you're saying, see, I've done magic tricks. I've integrated magic tricks into my curriculum. Not very often. There's like two tricks that I've done that are actually really purposeful. And then my students say, oh, do more. And I'm like, and then I feel like a dog, you know, like, no, no, thanks.
Yes. I'm not your monkey.
Yeah, exactly. Do a trick. I'm like, no. And then I kind of stopped because I didn't like having to say no. It was weird. And then I realized, well, that trick that I do at the beginning to talk about, it's a storytelling. It's a way to demonstrate storytelling using a magic trick, which is really a story with, you know, three sort of plot points.
Right.
So I kind of brought it back now because I realized, okay, it's powerful enough and I'll just get over the fact that I don't want to be their monkey, I suppose. Have you sang songs in your class?
Yeah, I have. And I've done lessons where I've sort of tried to teach them about songwriting too. Especially when I was a student teacher, like bringing that stuff into, because I mean, that's the stuff that I have in my pocket always, right? I can always pull that out.
Yeah.
But I mean, whatever school I'm at, I try and write about them too, and make a song that's sort of particular to that experience that I'm having. So
that's so cool that they get into. So we'll maybe end off here because this is about the creative process. So they get to bear witness to the creative process by being sort of a topic of the song you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and so like at the end of my like practice teaching rounds, I wrote a song about every place that I was at and, you know, included and just showed them that you can write about, you know, the experiences that you have. So, you know, it was funny things that would happen in the classroom and they were in the song. And the, you know, the song was more of like a summary of my month there, or however long it was.
I bet they loved that.
Yeah, it was great because it was like, I don't think many student teachers actually wrote songs about them.
No.
And in most cases we had already been writing songs sort of together as well, you know, and I taught them about writing for kids and we sort of started with that and saying, you know, if you can write for kids and hold their attention, like there's a lot of things you can do after that.
Yeah.
So, and it's very simple at times, it's very simple writing, but it's a formula too. So they learned then that creativity, sometimes there's still a formula, and that's okay.
That's interesting.
You know, it's not just all free form.
Well, you know, that's right. Act one,
throwing
act two,
it at
act
the wall
three.
And see what sticks. You know, like sometimes, like you that's sort fine. Of know what you're going to throw, and
there's
you know
form,
how big the wall is, and you know, and you need to know what it's going to look like
at the end of the day.
Yeah,
yeah. It's you know, jazz. We're all sort of playing the same tune, but we can do our own thing here and there as long as we get back to the to the tune we're playing.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't even like jazz.
Okay. but the creative process, we interviewed Alex Moustakas from Drayton Entertainment, and one of his board members is a guy who got involved in theater because as a youth, he was involved in theater, and then he had an opportunity to go to theater school. I think three theater schools accepted him, and then one architectural school accepted him, and he decided to do the architectural route because he wanted to, you know, have a job, right? Didn't want to do the creative thing. And then he just got out of the creative thing. But he said he develops homes. He's a big development guy, huge, that he, when he hires, he looks for people that have some sort of experience in the creative process because it changes their way of thinking. Mm-hmm. They're free thinkers. They're open-minded thinkers.
Yeah.
And they're good at problem solving. Exactly like you said, there's a template. You don't have to stick to it. You have to understand it and then play around with the form and come up with the same results at the end of the day. So I think I think in school and in these days when people are cutting back in schools, the creative arts are often the first things to go, right?
Yeah, so, and it's the most dangerous thing, I think, is to, you know, stifle creativity.
Yeah,
because
otherwise,
the arts exist and they're cross-curricular. I mean, everyone, you know, says that, but it's totally true. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you have a... If you have someone who thinks artistically, then like they have fewer limits, I think. Like it's a sort of overused phrase of thinking outside the box, but that's essentially what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's and if you can think artistically in one area, like why wouldn't you? Then you're considering alternatives, you know, and that's like creativity is considering alternatives and putting them to use. And you can do that in any subject.
And providing a space for the students to do that.
Exactly.
And then we got to provide a space for our kids to get cleaned up and get to bed, eh?
Exactly.
All right.
It's past their bedtime.
Well, that's past my bedtime now, man.
I hear you.
Okay, well, this was fun. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Keith Tomasek.
Okay, we'll look for the new CD.
All right, cool. Thanks.
Bye now. There you go. Thanks very much to Chris Patterson for making the time in his busy schedule to have a chat with me. It's so cool, both of us having kids. Mine just a little bit older than his. But recently Barack Obama said, "The future belongs to young people with an education and the imagination to create." And I was fortunate, so fortunate, to have a good drama teacher in high school and get involved in all kinds of artistic endeavors around that time of my life. So I, you know, hats off to people like Chris and all the other folks out there trying to introduce arts and creative approaches to things in the classroom. If you like the podcast, please tell all your friends. Please tell them. We need more people listening. They can find us on iTunes. Just look under The Inadequate Life in iTunes, in the iTunes store, or check out our website, theinadequatelife.com. One of the reasons I started this podcast is to remind everybody, myself included, that we all go through ups and downs in pursuit of creative inspiration. And part of living a creative life is taking risks, and more often than not, failing. But you have to start over, and you can't let those people in your way get you down. And don't let the tough times get you down. You know, they're going to pass. So the main thing you need to do, and I need to do, is surround yourself with good people and listen to them. It's amazing, as I talk to these creative folks on the podcast, how many of them talk about their support networks. Most importantly, work hard, take care of yourself. Come back every other Monday for a new episode of The Inadequate Life.